Today is Thursday, June 5th, and this is the World Socialist Website. The Way Forward in the Struggle Against Trump's Attack on Immigrants by Jacob Cross. Every day in the United States, heavily armed, militarized, and masked immigration agents, often operating without warrants or even the pretense of due process, are seizing workers, students, parents, and longtime residents as part of President Donald Trump's ongoing mass deportation campaign. Under the guise of combating terrorism and criminal gangs, the ongoing raids overwhelmingly target workers and their families, many of whom have filed for asylum and completed every legal requirement for seeking residence in the United States. In the first 100 days of Trump's second term, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, reported arresting well over 66,400 people and deporting 65,600. By mid-May, nearly 49,000 individuals were being held in immigration detention centers, most of them privately run, for-profit facilities scattered across the U.S. To meet a White House-imposed quota of 3,000 arrests per day, set by Trump's fascist-minded senior advisor Stephen Miller, masked immigration agents are appearing at courthouses, work sites, and other public spaces to capture so-called illegal immigrants. If their target is not present, the immigration Gestapo is encouraged to carry out collateral arrests, detaining anyone they encounter whom they suspect of being illegal, regardless of whether that person was the intended target. In line with these directives, the right-wing New York Post, owned by Rupert Murdoch's News Corp, reported that, quote, 2,200 illegal migrants, unquote, were arrested in a single day on Tuesday. This came after a Monday press conference by ICE Acting Director Todd Lyons, who gloated that immigration agents had detained 1,461 people in Massachusetts in May alone as part of Operation Patriot. Trump and his ruling class allies have repeatedly claimed that those being targeted for deportation are the spearhead of an invasion force aimed at destroying America. This lie is disproven every day. On Wednesday, CNN reported that the Trump administration is reviving its notorious child separation policy and has already taken approximately 500 children into government custody, removing them from previously vetted family sponsors. During Trump's first term, more than 5,500 children were separated from their parents in a cruel and inhumane effort to deter immigrants and asylum seekers. As of 2024, according to Human Rights Watch, over 1,000 of those children still had not been reunited with their families. Every day brings new outrages. On Tuesday, KTLA in Los Angeles reported that Martir Gracia Lara, a fourth-grade student at Torrance Elementary School, and his father attended an immigration hearing in Houston, Texas, at which point both were detained and separated by ICE agents. There is growing popular opposition to the Trump administration's vicious assault on immigrants and their families. Demonstrations against the administration's policies are becoming more frequent and militant, reflecting a deepening mood of resistance. In Chicago on Wednesday, over 100 people attempted to block ICE agents from kidnapping 12 individuals who were detained while appearing for a check-in at immigration court. The presence of the crowd prompted the deployment of dozens of Chicago police officers to the area. At one point, protesters attempted to block the van disappearing the immigrants. The day before, in Minneapolis, Minnesota, a similar scene unfolded when FBI, Homeland Security investigations, and Drug Enforcement Agency thugs conducted a federal operation at Las Cuatro's Milpas, a restaurant at East Lake Street that bears the slogan, "Make Tacos, Not Walls." The presence of dozens of heavily armed agents, including tactical FBI teams carrying M4 rifles with silencers, provoked widespread anger in the community. Minneapolis police were dispatched to protect the federal agents and arrested two people for allegedly assaulting police. and in San Diego on May 30th, over 100 residents came out to oppose an ICE operation targeting a local Italian restaurant. ICE and HSI agents resorted to flashbang grenades in an attempt to disperse the crowd, but were instead driven out by residents and restaurant workers. These protests speak to the growing opposition to the fascistic Trump administration and its assault on democratic rights, with its central target being immigrant families. This opposition to Trump must be armed with a clear political orientation. The Trump administration is seeking to establish a political dictatorship. The same regime that is carrying out mass deportations is criminalizing opposition to the genocide in Gaza, invoking the 18th Century Alien Enemies Act to imprison and expel political dissidents, defying court rulings, and rapidly militarizing American society. Far from opposing Trump's assault on immigrants, the Democratic Party has paved the way for it and continues to collaborate in its implementation. It was Democrat Bill Clinton who, in the 1990s, spearheaded border militarization and the criminalization of undocumented immigrants. Barack Obama deported more people than any president in U.S. history, while Vice President Kamala Harris infamously told migrants in 2021, "Do not come." The Democrats' response to the return of Trump has been a combination of collaboration and suppression of opposition. In January, Democrats joined Republicans in passing the reactionary Laken Riley Act, which mandates the detention of any undocumented immigrant accused of even minor offenses like shoplifting. As for independent Senator Bernie Sanders, he told ABC News that Trump had done right in attacking immigrants and, quote, making sure our border is stronger, unquote. In contrast to the Democrats, who are collaborating with the fascist president and his assault on democratic rights, workers and youth resisting today's deportation operations stand in historic continuity with those who, at great personal and legal risk, resisted efforts to enforce the Fugitive Slave Act of 1850. The horrors of the Fugitive Slave Act led millions to conclude that there could be no compromise with the slave power, and that the only recourse was mass revolutionary action to guarantee the safety and democratic rights of all. The defense of immigrants today is, at its core, a class question. The brutal methods now being used against undocumented workers, raids, surveillance, indefinite detention, deportation without trial, will be used against all those who oppose the policies of the corporate and financial oligarchy. Trump and the entire political establishment promote the poisonous lie that immigrants are responsible for the social crisis in the U.S., a lie repeated by the ruling elites of every country. Even as they are implementing a historic assault on social programs aimed at financing massive handouts to the rich and an enormous escalation of imperialist war, the working class must reject all attempts to divide it along national or ethnic lines. The fight to defend immigrant workers can succeed only through the united mobilization of the working class as a whole, black, white, native-born, immigrant, documented, and undocumented alike. This means building rank-and-file workplace and neighborhood committees to oppose the deportation operations and prepare collective actions using the immense social power of the working class. The defense of immigrants and the democratic rights of all is inseparable from the fight to abolish the capitalist system. It requires the building of a mass socialist movement committed to ending all borders, ending imperialist war, and securing the right of all people to live and work wherever they choose, free from repression, exploitation, or fear. New York's Whitney Museum suspends long-standing program in the face of protest over censoring of pro-Palestinian event, by David Walsh. Officials at the Whitney Museum of American Art in New York City have suspended the museum's famed Independent Study Program, or ISP, for 2025-26 confront it with widespread criticism and protest over its censoring of a pro-Palestinian event. A May 14th student performance, connected to the ISP, entitled No Aesthetic Outside My Freedom, Mourning Militancy and Performance, was canceled by the museum on the grounds that during a previous version of the event, one of the artists had asked anyone who supported Israel to leave. This, Whitney's pious leadership declared, violated the museum's anti-harassment policies. This is specious and hypocritical. The Whitney, along with other leading New York art institutions, has significant connections to the Zionist establishment and pro-Israeli bodies and individuals in the U.S. Hyperallergic noted that ISP's associate director, Sarah Nadal Melcio, insisted that the ISP had agreed to stage the performance and not the introduction, but this did not change the museum's decision, unquote. At a protest May 23rd, sparked by the cancellation of the student performance, according to Hyperallergic, protesters handed out, quote, 600 mock museum pamphlets identifying specific board members and their ties to Zionist, militarized, and surveillance-oriented entities. The trifolds named Nancy Carrington Crown, whose family members are major shareholders of General Dynamics, the arms and information systems company that has supplied the Israeli military with bombs and ammunition, Estee Lauder heir Leonard Lauder, whose brother Ronald is the president of the World Jewish Congress and a chairman emeritus of the Jewish National Fund, and billionaire Lori Tisch, whose cousin Jessica Tisch became the New York City Police Commissioner last November, end quote. Alleged harassment is a major issue for the Whitney. Association with the Israeli murder machine, however, is not. In a statement, the artists behind the canceled performance piece, Noel Magathy, Fadel Fakhouri, and Fargo Tabaki, noted that, quote, in the time since our performance was canceled by the Whitney, Israel has brutally murdered more than 600 Palestinians, all while continuing to enforce mass starvation and famine as a method of genocide in Gaza. In the face of this ongoing and escalating brutality, the decision to cancel our performance, a performance whose purpose is to mourn Palestinians martyred in the long struggle for liberation, matters very little. It is an act of anti-Palestinian censorship, yes, an act of cowardice by an institution materially complicit in the genocide, whose board members profit from the bombs and jets committing the genocide, yes, it is also a distraction, end quote. The Whitney's ISP was established in 1968 by Ron Clark. It is a non-granting program, according to the museum's website, that, quote, provides a setting within which students pursuing art practice, curatorial work, art historical scholarship, and critical writing engage in ongoing discussions and debates that examine the historical, social, and intellectual conditions of artistic production. The program encourages the theoretical and critical study of artistic practices, end quote. There is obviously a limit to the degree of critical thought and study the museum will permit. This sort of language turns out to be mere window dressing, insincere double talk. In reality, the Whitney, like every leading institution in the U.S., throws principles and democratic concerns out the window, confronted with pressure from the far right and the pro-Israeli lobby. Quoting, the ISP consists of three interrelated parts, studio program, critical studies program, and curatorial program. Many of the participants are enrolled at universities and art schools and receive academic credit for their participation, while others have recently completed their formal studies, unquote. Alumni of the program include artists Jennifer Allora, Greg Bordowitz, Tony Coates, Daniel Dean, Mark Dion, Andrea Fraser, Latoya Ruby Fraser, Felix Gonzalez Torres, Renee Green, Jenny Holzer, Emily Desir, Glenn Ligon, Rukrik Tiravijania, and Julian Schnabel. Critics and art historians Yui Copeland, Miwon Kwan, Pamela M. Lee, and Roberta Smith, and curators Carlos Pasualdo, Naomi Beckwith, and Sheena Wagstaff. In a strong statement, Catalan writer, curator, and educator Nadal Masia, who became the ISP's first associate director in 2024 and who has now been let go by the Whitney, pointed out that the work of the study program, quote, has always been unapologetically engaged with the politics of its time. The ISP began amid the revolutionary energies of May 68, the movement against the Vietnam War, the state violence of the Kent State Massacre, and fully coalesced around AIDS activism 2 decades later. Today, this means participants in the program continue to think for themselves and provoke thought in others about context, including but not limited to fascism at home and the relentless genocide being carried out in Gaza. And sadly, today, this means that we also face unprecedented censorship and a threat to our foundational independence because of our pursuit of the very dialogue that makes the ISP what it is, end quote. Nadal Malcio rejected the ostensible reason for the cancellation of No Aesthetic Outside My Freedom, asserting that, quote, the point of artistic freedom has never been that it shies away from controversy or anger, and the point of defending it has never been that we agree with everything an individual says. The point is that we must refuse the right-wing extremism that seeks to dictate what everyone is allowed to believe and express. The point is to insist on a free society and to stand in solidarity with other individuals and educational institutions under attack by this newly amplified right-wing extremism. Over 300 ISP alumni issued an open letter in May expressing support for the students, quote, who were censored when presenting work in solidarity with the struggle for Palestinian freedom and affirming our shared solidarity against the ongoing genocide in Gaza, end quote. The letter states its repudiation of the Whitney censorship, as well as, quote, the financial and socio-political entanglements the board of the Whitney Museum holds in relation to this genocide. End quote. The alumni argued that the, quote, canceled performance, scrutinized artwork and scholarship, and atmosphere of censorship have their roots in a broader political climate of fear and intimidation in the United States, and follow other recent crackdowns on free expression, protest, and speech by artists and scholars supporting Palestine. In Providence, Rhode Island, Butler Hospital plans to permanently replace striking workers, by Kate Randall. As the strike by 800 workers at Butler Hospital in Providence, Rhode Island, ended its third week, management announced Tuesday that it is posting job listings to permanently replace striking workers. Mary Moran, president and chief operating officer of Butler, said this attack on strikers' jobs was a, quote, necessary decision. Moran stated, quote, we believe this action is essential to ensure continuity of patient care and maintain the stability of our services. Butler says striking workers who are permanently replaced will not be able to return to their jobs once the strike ends. They will instead be placed on a preferential hire list and would only be able to return when and if a position becomes available. The announcement by Butler to replace the striking workers with scabs is a declaration of war. The move follows the cutoff of strikers' health insurance, including medical, dental, and vision coverage, as of June 1st. Other benefits, including life, disability, and accident insurance, had been cut off earlier in May by the company in retaliation for the strike. This threat must be answered through the broadening of the struggle, appealing to healthcare workers and others throughout the region to come to the strike's defense. The entire 450,000-strong membership of 1199 SEIU United Healthcare Workers East must be mobilized for mass actions to force management to back down. To prepare such action, workers must begin organizing lines of contact with each other through the building of rank-and-file strike support committees uncontrolled by union officials, who are doing everything they can to isolate the strike. Butler workers began their strike on May 15th, after 91% of the workforce, or 99% of the workers participating, voted to strike. The strike involves nurses, mental health workers, social workers, clerical, environmental service, and dietary staff, members of 1199 SEIU New England, a subsidiary of the larger 1199 SEIU. It is the first strike in 37 years at the 168-bed private psychiatric hospital, which provides mental health and substance abuse services to adolescents, adults, and seniors. Butler Hospital, a nonprofit operated by Care New England, is the flagship facility for Brown University's Department of Psychiatry. Care New England showed a $3.4 million operating gain for the first quarter of 2025, according to recent filing reports. As Butler's president and COO, Moran is paid more than $575,000 annually in salary and compensation. Strikers are demanding wage increases to lift workers out of poverty, improve staffing, stronger protections against workplace violence, and defense of their defined pension benefits for all workers, including new hires. Striker Dan told RI Future News, quote, "We need to get our wages to an appropriate level. We have members who are struggling to feed their families and living in cars, and these people have to come in and help other people. When people are struggling, it reduces the quality of our service. We're dealing with record numbers of assaults in the hospital, and we have proposals. We are focused on working with management to solve these issues. We need to ensure that we can be safe in our workplace. People shouldn't be afraid to go to work. Part of what we want out of this is appropriate pay and lower staff turnover, which has been affecting the quality of care. Consistency is an important part of psych care." Claims that Butler Hospital has no money to provide workers decent wages and benefits is a lie. While Butler is chronically understaffed and workers face violence on a daily basis, the hospital has shelled out more than $2 million to hire replacement workers. More than 150 people spoke out on Facebook in response to an article about Butler's plans to permanently replace striking workers. One supporter said, quote, "These workers do care about their patients. That's exactly why they're striking. Not because they don't care, but because they're being pushed past the point of physical and emotional exhaustion while being underpaid and unsafe. They face daily assaults, verbal abuse, and impossible staffing ratios, yet they keep showing up day after day because they do care," unquote. Negotiators from the Federal Mediation and Conciliation Service, or FMCS, arrived in Rhode Island the week of May 26th to oversee talks between Butler Hospital and SEIU 1199. After negotiating sessions on May 29th and May 30th, management claims the union failed to make adequate concessions on wages and benefits. Details of the latest offer by management have not been made public, but Care New England says they have offered wage increases averaging 3.4 to 8.5% annually, totaling between 15.6 and 32% over a proposed four-year contract. The hospital claims that only about 20% of employees earn below $20 an hour. Their latest offer would raise the wage floor to $19.32 per hour, with 99% of workers earning a paltry $20 or more by the end of the contract, far short of keeping up with inflation and raising workers out of poverty. The union has only asked for wages of $25 per hour minimum, which would not be enough to lift workers out of poverty. A single adult with one child needs to earn $39.30 an hour to rise above poverty level, according to MIT's Living Wage Calculator. Some staff are currently earning as little as $15.53 per hour, and others $21 to $23 per hour. Negotiators for Butler and the union reconvened for talks along with the FMCS on Wednesday, June 4th. A delay requested by Butler conveniently allowed management to cut off health care coverage over the weekend on June 1st. Most workers sought coverage through HealthSource Rhode Island, the state's affordable care marketplace, where many plans come with higher premiums and out-of-pocket costs than those workers had through Butler. A key proposal by Butler is that defined pension benefits be replaced for new hires with a 401k-style retirement plan. Such plans leave workers at the mercy of the gyrations of the stock market, which is all the more volatile due to Trump's trade tariff chaos. Capitalist enterprises like Care New England are also aiming to pass on to workers reductions in payments from Medicare and Medicaid contained in any new budget passed by Congress. Butler workers are in a powerful position to defeat management's threats. but $11.99 SEIU, which covers healthcare workers in Rhode Island, New York, New Jersey, Massachusetts, Maryland, Washington, D.C., and Florida, is working to isolate them from the struggles of other healthcare workers in the region. 2 weeks ago, it called off a statewide nursing home strike in Connecticut, which would have involved over 6,400 caregivers across 51 nursing homes and 193 group homes for individuals with disabilities, after an agreement was reached with Democratic Governor Ned Lamont. Union members were forced to vote on that tentative agreement the same morning it was reached, giving them no time to study or consider its details. The agreement fell far short of the $30 an hour demanded by workers, and wages will rise to only $26 an hour for certified nursing assistants, or CNAs, by January 1, 2028. Group home workers' pay will increase from a poverty level of $18 an hour to only $20 an hour during this same period. Any increases are also dependent upon Medicaid payment increases negotiated with the state. The Connecticut strike, in turn, had been deliberately delayed in order to not coincide with a strike of hundreds of nursing home workers in Western New York, also members of 1199 SEIU, who went on a 7-day strike beginning May 20th to demand better pay, staffing levels, and pensions. Workers must mobilize from below to override these betrayals. Workers must form a rank-and-file committee to take control of the strike and make an urgent appeal to other health care facilities, both union and non-union, across New England and beyond. Such a committee would establish lines of contact to organize joint actions to force management to back down. An expansion of the struggle is only possible through a fight against the 1199 SEIU apparatus, which is joined at the hip with the pro-capitalist Democratic Party and with management. A rank-and-file committee at Butler Hospital would fight against the subordination of healthcare to profit, which is incompatible with high-quality public health. This has been Paul Fuller for the World Socialist Website.
The World Socialist Website is published by the International Committee of the Fourth International, the ICFI, the leadership of the World Socialist Movement, the Fourth International founded by Leon Trotsky in 1938. The World Socialist Website relies entirely on the donations of readers and listeners for financial support. To give to the WSWS or to set up a regular monthly contribution, go to wsws.org/donate. We urge our listeners to join the International Committee of the Fourth International and one of its affiliated political parties and take up the struggle for socialism.